Are the walled gardens of the real world at all like the walled gardens we think of when we consider the web? Or is this just a case of metaphor gone wild? The answers to these questions and more on this week's Radio Berkman. Picture a Victorian garden. A beautiful landscaped garden enclosed by a solid brick wall or a wrought iron gate. Idyllic yet protected, bountiful but sealed off, made available to some, but not to all. Those in information technologies adopted the metaphor of a walled garden to describe areas on the net where users and the user experience are in some way quarantined. You might think of America Online in the 1990s, a subscription service that controlled access and created its own version of the web for its users. The iPhone is a more recent example. The iPhone's App Store may have single-handedly invented the marketplace for talented independent coders to homebrew interactive mobile utilities with the best of them. But Apple still has a bouncer outside the App Store, kicking out applications like Google Voice to keep their user experience pure. Walled gardens are generally frowned upon by advocates of a more open net, but today's guest encourages us to look back at the metaphor of the garden and listen to what it can tell us about how we construct our experiences on the web. Elizabeth Goodman is a PhD student at the UC Berkeley School of Information and a design researcher with Intel. She sat down with David Weinberger to talk about her research.
I'd been doing all of this work on essentially typologies of places. You know, when I looked at what I'd been doing, I had been way considering taking as my unit of analysis the sidewalk or the street corner. And I thought to myself, I need a new research project. What should I look at? And I started kind of casting about a bit and looking at cities. And I realized parks, to begin with, were really interesting sites of urban life. They are very political, they're very deeply constructed and designed, and I've looked at the ways in which parks are sites of negotiation in cities about what politicians and interest groups want for the city and for themselves. And so I decided that even though it seemed a bit unlikely to look for new and emerging technologies in public parks, that's what I would do. As one does, my interest in public parks got wider and wider and wider, and I started looking at urban green space, and I started looking at window boxes and backyard gardens, and yes, public park volunteering, and that surprisingly looped me back around to notions of politics and neighborhood building and collective action in a somewhat more bounded site, which is the community garden. And I had not paused to consider that the community gardens that I was looking at were like walled gardens until a conversation with Dana Boyd, who immediately, looking at these pictures of fenced-off gardens, said, "Hey, aren't those walled gardens?"
The recognition that these are walled gardens, there's obviously that phrase is used in relation, has been used for 15, 20 years for technology, for the internet in particular. Why suspect that there's anything interesting to learn about the fact that we use the same term to describe community gardens in the real world and AOL and other such places in the early days of the internet?
The use of the phrase seems so dreadfully impoverished next to the kind of richness of the experience that I was seeing in my research. I mean, it's kind of a commonplace since George Lakoff's Women, Fire, and Dangerous Things to talk about the way in which metaphors shape not just how we see the world, but what we feel like we can do in the world and the way in which our actions seem to us to be logical. And I began to wonder, well, if this metaphor of the walled garden seems to be kind of limited and impoverished, does that mean that, in fact, all of these activities we're taking on the basis of the walled garden metaphor, could it be that if we opened up our consideration of that metaphor, would we find more spaciousness, more possibilities opening up in thinking about walled gardens online or designing online spaces than we'd seen before?
So in looking at real-world walled gardens and online metaphorically designated walled gardens, what are the comparison points? What are the big contrasts? And what do we learn from the careful study of real-world walled gardens?
The first kind of big difference, let's say, is the bits and atoms difference. I'm not saying that plants are like files, you know, and we had this conversation about how hard it is to grow plants versus how hard it is to copy a file. The two, in some ways, aren't comparable in the kinds of investment and labor that we have to put in. Ironically, of course, the reproduction of plants is of great concern to gardeners, and the out-of-control reproduction of weeds makes gardeners very unhappy. The out-of-control reproduction of files and spam makes other people unhappy. But more or less, plants are not digital files. They just aren't. And we need to work from that material grounding.
And it's not just the atoms. I mean, a lot of it has to do with the time as well.
It's absolutely, you know, we think of the internet in almost instantaneous time. And in fact, when I spoke with community gardeners, much of what they loved about gardening and gardens was the way in which they opposed it to online worlds. They saw it as being slow, cyclical, tangible. You know, we can keep on going with the metaphors and verbs out of their control. In some ways, engaging in gardening was a bit of a stand against mechanization, industrialization, virtualization, and a retrenchment towards a notion of a more authentic human way of life. I mean, not for everyone, but for many people.
More rooted.
More rooted, exactly.
You can't escape the metaphors.
You cannot. So in a lot of ways, I actually saw these gardens. This is getting away from the walled gardens online conversation, but I actually saw these gardens as sites of contestation of the category of the technological in people's lives, what they wanted for technology, what they saw as the role of new technologies in their lives. And the gardens were actually, in contrast, imagined quite often as refuges from phones, from computers, from desk jobs, from speed, etc.
Did you notice, because you have spent a long time observing people working in public gardens, community gardens, have you noticed a difference in how they use their digital devices, their cell phone or their iPhone or whatever, when they're in the garden? Does the garden change their relationship to the technology that in some cases they're trying to withdraw from?
I'll tell you a story. Here I am talking with this guy, and he's just given me this very persuasive and moving talk about how people don't have real emotions online and how computer-mediated communication is kind of leeching authentic friendships out of the world. And, you know, it's really moving, and I'm feeling kind of embarrassed about my dependence on iChat at that point. And then his phone rings. He says, excuse me. He takes it. He has a long conversation with his boyfriend. They sign off. They're quite loving. He puts the phone away, and I didn't say anything at the moment, but I thought, didn't you just finish telling me that computers were the problem? Here's this mini computer in your pocket, which you take to the garden with you. Okay, so what we're dealing with is not necessarily a kind of literal aversion to technology. Instead, it's this kind of deployment of symbolic moments of technology use or non-use in ways that are really satisfying to people. That's one of the things, again, going back to the metaphorical walled gardens that attracted me to that study, is that the walled gardens online are also really loaded, you could say overloaded, with symbolic attachments. So at this past talk I gave, I showed these pictures that people use to illustrate the concept of the walled garden online. And ironically, you know, the text will kind of rail against the evils of walled gardens. And then it's illustrated with this very beautiful picture of a calm, lush, quiet, serene, enclosed space.
A real garden.
A real garden.
Real Victorian garden.
Exactly, yeah. With, you know, beautiful wrought iron gates. You're seeing a bit of a dissonance there.
The dissonance, I think, is historical to some degree because just from memory, so I could, of course, be wrong, but I remember the term walled garden being first used to describe AOL by non-AOLers who looked with some disdain upon those who were in the walled garden of AOL. But AOL's, instead of being out in the wild internet, AOL's pitch, its benefit to users, was that it took this wild, untamed place where you can't find anything and you might find stuff you don't want ever to see, and instead they made it beautiful, like a Victorian garden, or, you know, beautiful in a pop sort of way with smiley faces and here's the news and here's the weather and here's your mail and here's some ads. But it was all very carefully plotted and laid out just like a garden. It was all actually, in its own way, quite beautiful, its own tacky way. And that's the image of the walled garden that corresponds to the beautiful Victorian garden. And it was later on that I think this term got maybe more applied to places that are walling up their content and, you know, the New York Times going behind the paywall and that sort of thing.
I think the next step for this project is to look at the historical transformations in the use of the term over the past 20 years. I think that doing that kind of comparative view on the term can help pull out some of why it's been meaningful and then the ways in which it's, as I said, kind of symbolically overloaded. It can, it's taken on so many different meanings. And then, you know, I of course think that the way you think about the future is to look at the past. So, you know, moving from that basis, we can defamiliarize our assumptions about what walled gardens mean and think about opening up the discussion a bit. I think there's a little bit of contrarianism motivating this project. You know, just as the original project was motivated by a bit of contrarianism, in which people told me that I was, you know, crazy for looking at information systems in green spaces. Don't you know that they're natural? Why would there be information systems in green spaces? Why is digital information important? And in the same way, and I said, oh, no, I will find these interesting examples of the way in which green spaces are kind of constructed through and around digital information. And for example, in the case of public Wi-Fi in parks, that's pretty clear. But anyway, getting back to the walled gardens, in the same way, the use of the walled garden as a kind of automatic pejorative kind of pushes my buttons a bit, you know? I hate to see a perfectly innocent term suddenly becoming a kind of hot button, kind of like silo. You know, silos are used to store grain. They're perfectly reasonable parts of the industrial landscape of farming, and you can have issues with the consequences. But from my own personal perspective, I find terms like that, seemingly innocent terms that come to be fighting words, immensely for opening up and starting discussions. Because they, you know, again, there's this dissonance. Why is this word that is in some contexts so pleasant and so positive tremendously contentious elsewhere? And that, I think, is a kind of difference in use that we can use to kind of pry open otherwise unexplored questions. I mean, the nice thing about walled gardens is that they remind you that you always do need walls. There are always walls of some sort. I think at the talk I just gave, someone raised a lovely point. Of course, there are always walls. The question is just how permeable and transparent are they? How easy is it for people to move in and out? And how easy is it for the goods that they value to be moved in and out? And that's really the question for me, not so much whether the walls exist or not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Goodman is a PhD student at the UC Berkeley School of Information and a design researcher with Intel. You can find her on the web at www.confectious.net. You can also find video and audio of a recent talk by Elizabeth and a back catalog of all our episodes at the Radio Berkman site at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.